this talk by Douglas Harding, titled Enlightenment and Social Responsibility, was recorded at the Buddhist Society in London in January 1971.
I hope first to try to say something about what enlightenment is. In fact, not merely to talk about it, but to do something about it, usually. And secondly, to just mention some of our more serious social difficulties, our current problems, and to inquire how enlightenment throws light upon these problems, what enlightenment has to say about these problems, how enlightenment could help to solve these problems. And thirdly, to answer the obvious objection that it's all very well, but what's the use of my seeing who I am and getting enlightened? What's the use of that in the face of the gigantic social problems that confront all of us? In other words, the third part will, if we have time, consider how practical enlightenment is. How practical in the contemporary world with its gigantic problems. So in the second part I shall be taking certain sample problems of the current scene, I hope we can mention half a dozen or so of them. These will only be samples, really, but we can consider in a little detail how enlightenment affects these problems, what it has to say about these problems. But to begin with, what is enlightenment? And I'm not going to try to give you a Buddhist or intellectual or worthy or clever answer to this. I'm going to suggest that we just try out now the business of really seeing how it is where we are, seeing into our nature, seeing what we are like without delusion. And when we see how it is being ourselves without any delusion whatever at this moment of time, without memory, without importing into the situation a lot that isn't given, then believe that we are enlightened. What is enlightenment about? It is about one's true nature, one's self. One is enlightened, surely, about who or what one is. One looks to see without prejudice how it is being oneself, sitting on one's chair, this evening. And before we come on to social questions, it's quite obvious that we've got to try this business of seeing who we are, getting, let us hope, enlightenment, getting light on this question of who we are. Well now, I'm not in a position to tell you who or what you are, for the very simple and obvious reason that I'm not sitting in your chair. I am X feet away from your chair, and I am simply enjoying your appearance. I can see a human being sitting in your chair. I cannot see what it's like to you where you are. I see your appearance. And I have reason to suspect that your reality, where you are, from which this appearance, which I'm now enjoying, springs, is different from what I can see. And I'm going to invite you to attend, along with me, not to Douglas sitting here, but to yourself sitting where you are, to look at what it's like where you are. Or in other words, to see not only what you're looking at, namely Adam Douglas, but to see what you're looking out of. See what you're looking out of. And you say this is rather difficult. Well, I don't find it so. I find it very easy to see what I'm looking out of at the moment. I can see what I'm looking at, which is all your faces, etc. And I'm seeing what I'm looking out of here and noticing how different it is in my chair from what it is in your chair. Because I'm talking now in extremely simple language, I hope simple language, about something supremely and utterly simple. Not about ideas, not about Buddhism, not about religion or spirituality. I'm talking about something utterly secular, ordinary, factual, plain, baby-like, childish, almost idiotic. I'm talking about what is given to me at this moment when I stop thinking. And I find, in all sincerity and simplicity, I find here nothing in your way. When I look not only at you that I'm looking at there, but at myself, which I'm looking out of, I find that I'm looking out of nothing whatever. That I'm the only person in the room who is in this condition as far as I can see it. Because I alone here am a person to myself, and you're all third person to me. And what I'm really saying, in other words, is let us look at the difference between oneself as first person and oneself others as third person. I swear I'm not like you as third person. But you, I'm just like the other people in the room, complete from here downwards. You can see a complete torso. Most of you can see a complete torso. It's not like that at all here. I swear to you that my condition here is not like that at all. Here, I am capacity for you. I am full of you. You are in me, and there's just nothing here in your way. I'm looking out of no face here at your face. And the situation is entirely asymmetrical. Now, if you look at Anne and myself looking at one another, you will see that the situation is very roughly symmetrical, and with certain small variations. What is here is more or less matched by what is here. And the number of eyes you can count as 2 plus 2 equals 4, number of noses 1 plus 1 equals 2. And there's an axis of symmetry somewhere about here, and this is somewhat like this. There are a few additional. But roughly, it's a symmetrical situation, isn't it? Now, if you would kindly turn your attention from Anne and me, just to me at this moment, and stop thinking, you have to just stop thinking and attend to what is given, I think you will see that the situation isn't like that at all. It isn't symmetrical, face to face. It is face, as far as I'm concerned anyway, taking any face that happens to be handy, supposing I took yours, if you don't mind, I find. Now, it is face to no face, and it's like that. No, not like that anymore. Not like that, you see, face to face. It is, for me, face to no face. And for you, I suggest, probably, hopefully, you may experience, from your point of view, what I do, which is face to no face. Well, my experience is that as first person, you see, the whole room is in me. And I am not a complete human being in the room. The whole room is in me. You are in me. And having lost this utterly, this box here, this is all gone, and it is completely void, completely empty. I am full of you. Now, if you will look at me, stop thinking about what I'm experiencing, and consider what you're experiencing at this moment without thinking about it, I believe you will enjoy the same experience. And it's utterly simple, utterly obvious once you get around to it. And if you just look at me and see whether you are face to face with me. As you think about it, you had it. Because you place Shirley on your shoulders to match my seen face, a thought up, a memory of face. I'm asking you to give up memory, to give up thought, and notice that the situation is now entirely asymmetrical, and it is like that. Nothing like this one that you see. It is Shirley, face to no face. If you like, I have traded faces with you. And you're the one that has the white beard. I can't find a white beard in this room, and it's your problem. It's nothing to... You're jolly well welcome to it. And if it went bright blue at this moment, it would be your problem. And it would be... I would be the last person to get wind of it. Wouldn't I? And I don't have a face here. Now you say, well, Douglas, you're crazy, because we can see you have. Well, I would only say, come and see. And on the way, you would lose it. On your journey here, you would lose it. Suppose you want to take photographs of me, you will do it from where you are. And you bring the camera up. You get me in the viewfinder. And as you approach, Douglas is replaced in the viewfinder. Hold at me by my torso. Then, as you approach, by my head, come nearer, by my nose, come nearer, it's replaced by all the skin, cells, and so on. And long before you arrive here, I have disappeared. I am completing the story and telling you how it is here. There's absolutely nothing here, I swear to you. Therefore, I am full of you. Now, I'm just asking you, is it the same with you? Or if you don't like this way of putting it, if this is difficult, don't consider. Look at how many eyes you're looking at me out of now. Are you looking out of two little slits in a meatball? Two. Is it dark where you are, and is that dark room lit by two little windows? Are you in a box there? Or are you at large? It's not something that can be settled by thinking about it. If you think about it, the whole thing is obscured. If you just look, how is it with you? So what is this enlightenment we're talking about, but just being truthful? In all simplicity, stopping thinking and being truthful about how it is sitting on the seat of your pants in your chair, going around the world. How is it? Where you are? What's it like being you? Now, a great Indian sage, Ramana Maharshi, people came to him and said, oh, master, I want self-realization, I want to see who I am, and so on, because this is such a marvelous thing, and it was shining out of him. And he said, you asked me about this, how can you avoid self-realization. It is the simplest thing in the world. All it consists of is attending to how it is, where you are. And you are the sole authority on how it is now, where you are. You are the one who can see what it's like where you are. And when you submit to this, just in all simplicity and honesty, notice what it's like where you are, and notice, I imagine, that you are not in a box, that you are empty and at large and therefore full of the world, full of what is confronting you. Notice this, you are self-realized. Now, Ramana Maharshi didn't put it in these terms, but he said, how can you fail? How can you fail to notice what it is like being yourself? This is not the achievement of something. This is not something you built up to. It's not something you gradually cultivate yourself to achieve. Not something for cultivation. It is something simply for noticing. All we have to do is to be simple and honest enough to see what it's like being first person singular, present tense. You see, what we've done is to get outside ourselves and look at ourselves from out there and say, I am what other people see me to be. And that is to thing oneself, to third person oneself, to shut oneself up in a box. Now, I'm inviting you to see how it is from where you are, at a distance of 0 feet, not a distance of 5 feet. And then, surely, you unthing yourself. You un-third person yourself. You see yourself as you are to yourself. And you are, while the experience lasts, while you're seeing this, truly self-realized person. There is nothing to see. There is nothing to do. Just to attend to how it is, where you are, and, as the Buddhists would say, see into your void nature. Well, hopefully a number of you, I'm sure quite a lot of you, are at this moment seeing what it's like right where you are, and seeing that you're not in a box, seeing that you're not looking at me out of the dark in interstices of some meatball, you know, some little box that's full of plumbing, out of two slits in it, that you are as wide as the room. The Buddhists, I came across some time ago in the Pali Canon of all places, a Buddhist scripture that says that there are two kinds of men, or two phases in one's life. And the first kind of man is a dweller in a small hardness, and the other kind of man is a dweller in the immeasurable. Well, are you in a small hardness, or are you at large? Well, this is for doing, this is for seeing, this is not for understanding. Let us now pass on to the application of what you are seeing to the current headaches of the world. I made a list a while ago of 13, appropriate number, 13 of them. And I'm not going to treat you to a detailed analysis of our 13 hang-ups, because you could add to them or think or bracket them together. In any case, there's no time. I think we can only take some samples and see how they work out in the most precise way, how enlightenment works out is tested by and works out in regard to these terrible problems that we are having. Some are peculiar to our time. Most of them, of course, are just a part of the human condition. And let us take, let's start with a very simple, one of the simpler ones, but a very, very important, and in some areas of the world, a very, very tragic question, the question of color, the question of race. Now, I'm going to ask you to suppose that I'm a black man, and Anne here is a white woman. Well, I don't have to suppose that. You can see that. I'm a Negro, you see. And you see that here is Douglas, a Negro, and here's Anne, a Caucasian. And it's black here and it's white there. Now, if Anne and I forget you and still work on this understanding that I'm the leader and she's the wise person, the story we have when we look at each other is in reverse, is it not? Because I am the person now who has the right, is seized of, who has the right face. And Anne is the person whose face, the only face she is now in receipt of, is there. And we have traded colour, haven't we? Anne and I traded colour. Not your story. Your story is I'm an eater and she's white. Our story is exactly the other way round on this platform. Well, this is for real. This is for real. I heard of a program, a television program in America, where a young Negro, a rather simple and stupid, perhaps seemingly stupid or wise young Negro, was being interviewed, and he was asked why he didn't get a job. He was out of work. And he said, well, when I go and seek work, you know, they tell me I'm black. But you know I'm not black. You say he was a fool. He was not a fool. He was speaking the truth, surely from his own point of view. Or put it like this if you wish. If I'm black, it's your problem. Here, I am not black. Or put it yet another way. Where do I keep my black face if I'm a Negro? I keep it 4 feet from here in the mirror. I keep it in you. I keep it in the camera. I keep it out there. I don't have it here. Here I have my, what in Buddhism calls my original bright and charming face, which is neither black, pink, yellow, brown, or anything else. My facelessness, which is colorless, featureless. And this is a real answer to a real problem. Now take another seemingly small, well, a problem which is in the news now. I'm starting off with these rather sort of, you might say, special problems. A problem which is well ventilated, well advertised at the moment, and that is the problem of smoking. Now, I happened to hear 2 days ago, I didn't hear the program, I happened to hear about the program, which some of you have seen, and maybe you will correct me as to the details of this program. But some smokers were there and explaining why they were hooked on nicotine, why they were smoking. And I gather that two of them said that it was to fill up the blank space between their ears, the emptiness between their ears. Have I got it right? Do any of you hear it? Seemingly not. But we had, you were all such non-smokers that you wouldn't be interested in that. But the fact is that we had studied this question of smoking, and long before this present hoo-ha arose, we had come to the conclusion that one of the reasons, I didn't say one, but one of the major reasons for smoking was in order to try and build up something here. You know, one is constantly, one is nothing here at all, but for reasons which there's not much time to go into, this is a very uncomfortable situation for some of us to be faced with. So what do we do? One of the ways of overcoming the evanescence, the disappearance, the fugitiveness of one's face, is to keep sticking a fag in it. And a downgrade pipe is perhaps even better, because you see this thing here, and you think, my God, something must be something to hold it in position. You know? Well, this is confirmed gratuitously by this program. We smoke cigarettes in order to try and build up the face we don't have between the ears we don't have. Because they were wrong about the ears, weren't they? What ears? I've got ears for you, but I don't have any hair. Well, now, it is fairly plain to me that one of the therapies for smoking, and perhaps one of the easiest therapies for smoking, is to say, get yourself statistically enlightened. Now, you may seem rather, you know, a funny way with motive getting your first enlightenment, but it's a great deal better than some of that I've heard advertised. It doesn't seem to me to matter how rotten your motive is for seeing who you are, as long as you see who you are. And my own motives, you know, for seeing who I was in the beginning were even more ridiculous or unworthy than giving up smoking. Well, those are two very specific instances, but let me come on to a more serious, an even more serious question of aggression, delinquency, violence, greed. Those, you can link these questions together, perhaps crime, delinquency, war, aggression, economic greed, and so forth. Let us lump all those together just because we want to economize in time. Now, I'm going to suggest that the root, what lies at the root of this constellation of problems, this group of problems, is something like this. When I was born, when I was an infant, I was at large. I was faceless, I was at large, I was not in a box. The world was mine. I was not in the world was in me. And the poet, writer who celebrated this vision above all is Thomas Traherne, you know, who talks about being crowned, clothed with the heavens and crowned with the stars when he was an infant. Other poets have written about it, and obviously it is true. I can't go into the evidence, but the evidence is conclusive, both from what infant children say and for other reasons. The evidence is conclusive that a child doesn't see himself as others see him, and a very young child doesn't see himself as others see him, in a little box. He is faceless and will tell you so, or headless and will tell you so, and often does. From his point of view, he is different from all the people around him. He is not in the box, he is at large. Now, he can't go on like this because he cannot understand other people, what they say to him, what they mean him to do. He can't understand their attitude to him while he is at large. Because he has to learn the very uncomfortable lesson that for other people he is not at large. He is a thing in the world of things. He is no more important than the next little boy, and he must, in order to live in society at all, learn the hard lesson of seeing himself as other people see him, boxed up, small, local, faulty, etc. And if he doesn't see this, he will end up needing institutional care. He really will. And there are, I believe, a large number of people in mental hospitals who haven't quite learned, or haven't learned at all, to see themselves through other people's eyes. A small, local thing. Well, he learns the lesson. Teachers, parents, friends, the whole of society is putting a face on him. It's inviting him to look at himself from a distance of five feet instead of 0 feet. The mirror is one of the ways of doing it, and this is another way of doing it, feeling here, and being told how horrible you are, or you've got a smut on your nose, or whatever. This is another way. Other people tell you. And none of these things does really build up a box on the little boy. But he builds up the idea of a box. He doesn't build up a box. Where he is as first person is just the same. He is still headless, faceless, at large. But he learns the lesson of seeing himself through other people's eyes only too well. We overlearn the lesson of kinghood, of third personhood. We overlearn the lesson. And we forget what it is like being ourselves. We forget what it was like to be at large. We say to ourselves, I am what other people see, I am not what I see. I am what I look like at 5 feet, I am not what I am at 0 feet. I am not what I am like in my chair, but what you can see from your chair. We put heads on us right where we are. We shut ourselves up in little boxes. Now, every one of us, I believe, has profound conviction that the world is ours, that we are infinite, that as the Pali Canon says, we are immense, 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 the biggest of world. Each of us in his heart knows he is the world. Surely, or speaking to myself, I'm convinced that I'm not a small thing in the world. I'm quite sure that all the world is mine. Am I unusual in this? I think not. I think in our hearts, we all of us believe that the whole is in us, and we are not a thing in the world, but the world is in us. Well, we have learned this sad lesson of being in a box. How do we get out of our box and get back into the world of the sound? Well, some of us try and collect a lot of money. Some of us try and collect some fame, some reputation, symbols, status symbols, keeping up with the Joneses, more pay, you know, regardless, etc. This isn't crude greed, I think. I think it is futile series of attempts to regain, if possible, just a little bit of our lost worldwide kingdom. It seems to me that the answer to acquisitiveness, greed, aggression, violence, this time, especially is to see that all the world is ours anyway and always has been. And it's ours more intimately than we could ever make it by getting it made over to us by a conveyance principle of it. I mean, the stars, if you look out here and hopefully the stars around, you will notice they're in you, surely. And how could they be more intimately in you and yours than the way they are? And when I look at Anne's face here, how could I own it? How could I own Anne's face more completely than I thought this moment? It is utterly, utterly mine. Because there is nothing in its worth. And yours now. You are mine. As Traherne says, all the world is mine. And he goes on, you know, in the superb passages about the young men and the maidens and the priests and the temples and the flowers and the stars. All were his, most intimate. And he was the sole possessor and enjoyer of them because he was not in a box, he was the flower. And in another place, in a poem called My Spirit, he talks about himself as a child and indeed in his own adult apprehension. He says, my essence was capacity, is capacity. No brims, nor borders. In my soul I see my essence is capacity. And surely as first person, one's essence is capacity. One is capacious of the whole world. One owns the whole world. Well, if I own the world, I'm not going to fuss about owning another swimming pool or another car or this or that status symbol. I should surely be interested only in those things which I need to function as a human being in practical ways. I shan't be seeking status symbols, shan't be seeking fame, reputation. I shan't be seeking to make an impression on everybody, to impress you. To own these little symbols of my largeness. When I am at large, I don't need to prove that I'm somewhat bigger than the thing you're seeing here. I'm infinitely bigger than the thing you're seeing here. And I don't have to have an estate of 100 acres to prove it. Take another question now. A rather particular nature. Drug misuse. What is the practical answer to this question of drug misuse? I think it is not practical, or compassionate, or understanding, or sensible. Say, wicked thing, this is all wrong. You ought to go and do it the proper way and sit for 10 years in Zendo in Japan or something like that and get it that way. I think that attitude, negative attitude, is no good. It's ineffective and unpractical. I think the practical thing to suggest to someone who wishes to explore the other levels of consciousness which presumably are available, to suggest that they see what we were trying to see at the beginning of this talk, and were seeing at the beginning of this talk in some cases, in many cases. See who we are. Now, it is the experience of friends who see these simple things to the extent that they do see it, and when they're seeing it. And the practice does come in here, admittedly. It is the experience I have noticed that they get what a good trip promises, but perhaps rarely fails to give. They become comparatively often very open. You see, when you lose the box here, you lose your faith, it isn't that you achieve this openness, this love, it is that you submit to the way it is. You are open. You don't achieve openness. You're busted wide open. And this experience of when you meet people, you are them, as I was and just chubby when I look at you again. This openness is not achieved, it is submitted to. The colors. There's one particular friend of mine, this woman, who was most amusing on this, at the time when he saw the simple absence here. He went out into the garden and looked at some roses, and we had a terrific job persuading him that those roses were not special roses imported from Holland, from a special variety, that they were ordinary roses. And I think with some of us, and this is with some of us, because the effects differ in each case, with some of us, one of the first and admittedly minor proofs of seeing who we are is that we're absolutely bowled over by sense experience, in particular colours. Traffic lights, the reflection of neon lights in London wet pavement. Sounds become, music becomes so much more exhilarating and tangent. Well, sense and taste and so on follow through in our experience, in the experience of many of us. Now here is surely a constructive answer. How to be high without drugs. How to be high without drugs. Well, I've taken some samples. I'll quickly mention just one more, which is even more important, and that is peace of mind. Peace of mind. When you see who you are, in the way we've been talking about, and trust it, I don't think anything can be promised. Certainly not bright colors or relaxation or liking everybody immediately. I don't think anything specific can be promised. What I'm saying hangs upon the fact, not upon the payoff. But I think there's one exception, and that is peace of mind. I really am sure, from my own experience and what my friends report to me, that when we see clearly who we are, we really experience homecoming. A peace of mind that is quite indescribable, is perfectly compatible with being rather sad and finding the situation around us quite troublesome. I would say that when we see who we are, we really put pay to the existential anxiety we have. You know, the feeling of being cast into an alien universe. No. Homecoming. We feel this is what we were for and the universe is about. Self-awareness, self-realization. seeing who they are, peace of mind. And if you'd like to take the other social problems which I haven't talked about, such as generation gap and all sorts of other things, you can see for yourself and work out for yourself how this basic thing that one is infinite, one is all, one is thought as purpose. You can see how this experience will deal with the problem so far as you are concerned, with the great social problem so far as you are concerned, and so far as the individual is concerned. Well, that concludes the second part of this course. The application of seeing who we are to our current social problem. I promised that the third bit would be an attempt to answer objections which have raised themselves in your mind, I'm sure, all over them, the objections in particular that this is all very well for you. You see who you are, you're having a lovely time, you've gone off your cigarettes, you're not taking drugs anymore, you're enjoying life, you've got peace of mind, and you're really fairly loving and open. But how is this going to affect Vietnam, and you know, how is it going to spread all around in time to rescue the world from its terrible condition? This is your query, and it's a just one, and I share your anxiety about it. What is the answer one can truthfully give? Well, I think the first point to make is that seeing who one is doesn't and cannot affect the outside world. Seeing who one is seeing what lies at the source of the world, where the world comes from, that void out of which it emerges. But when the world has emerged from this void, it is a world of opposites. It's a world of good and evil, ugliness and beauty, black and white, and grey, every shade of grey. And it seems to me that the world is always like, and we cannot look for perfection, or if we look for perfection out there, we are in for bitter disappointment. Perfection is available, and it's right where you are. At the point you occupy is absolute perfection, because what could go wrong there? On the other hand, outside this still center of your life is the world, and the world is a place of imperfection, of opposite duality. It is imperfectible. So utopia, the millennium, is just not on. But this doesn't mean to say that improvement isn't on. It doesn't mean to say that improvement is not desirable. I mean, obviously, these problems are terrible ones, and let's hope something can be done, something, some ambulance work upon these problems. I would say that all we can really reasonably hope for is some amelioration of the outer scene. Point one. Point two, I believe that there has been a fantastic acceleration in the evolution of human consciousness. I believe that an idea now, an experience now, gets round with fantastic speed, especially when its time has come. You know, there's a saying, there's nothing so powerful as an idea whose time has come. Well, I believe there are indications that the time has come, not foreseeing in the way I've been describing, because I've been describing only one gate, only one of the numerous gates to the apprehension of who we are. But I believe that the evidence is that this question of who am I is the great question of our age, and that the time is right for seeing who we are, and that the speed of the development of human consciousness has been much accelerated. Next point is that modern communications obviously lend themselves to this. Television and so on. A local idea, a local event, is worldwide within minutes or hours. You can still have doubts about this, but consider what has happened. Consider, not far from here, an old, very hairy gentleman working in British Museum called Karl Marx, nobody ever heard of. And there he was, an eccentric, perhaps, scholar, working in the British Museum. And they could have said to him, well, you know, what's the use of this in a world, you know, like this? Well, now, about half the world is communist on account of what he did. This sort of thing can happen and does happen. Another reflection is this. We get the idea that human nature is a fixed quantity, but after all, there was a time when we were not self-conscious. We didn't see ourselves in boxes before Homo was really a sapien, or thought he was. There was a time when he was like a little child at large, you know. And I think most primitive people got well beyond this stage now, but quite manifestly in the evolution of human consciousness was a stage before self-consciousness, in the sense in which we use it, had arrived. Well, now it is normal for us, all the people in this room, all of us in this room, have learned the art, the tragic, difficult, and misleading, deluding art of seeing ourselves without a fear. And this is a step in human evolution which is absolutely indispensable. Absolutely. But it suggests to us, doesn't it, that there's a third step. There's a third step now being taken in a number of places, and that is to come back, to see ourselves also as we see ourselves, to be truly self-conscious. And this thing, this mysterious and much advertised thing called enlightenment, what, after all, if we get down to the brass tacks, is it? But what one might call the next stage in human evolution. Surely it is that we see ourselves as we see ourselves, at a distance of naught feet in our void nature. We see our absolute clarity, our infinite capacity. We see what it is like to be a person. Now I'm going to shut up in about a few minutes. I have one other thing really to add about the question of practicality. Or two, perhaps. You know, we think we're being socially responsible when we read the paper every morning and just bellyache and just moan and groan about it. We think, well, you know, not like old Turner, perhaps Douglas, who doesn't dance beyond the headline. And go into it and really feel, you know, really worked up about the situation here and there and everywhere. We go to work with furrowed brow, with all the cares of the world on us, and we think we're being socially responsible. I submit to you that this is a terrible social irresponsibility. It is adding to the burdens of the world. It is spreading round that very thing which you are moaning about. It is adding to the trouble, isn't it? It's loading further burdens on the world. And if it is accompanied by no local action to alleviate the situation, then it is even worse. It is being socially irresponsible. On the other hand, if we accept our limitations, see who we are, and let this affect our lives in the full circle of our job, our home, our acquaintance. If we let it work there, at least we are doing something in this very small sphere to alleviate the world. We're not just sitting reading the papers and bellyaching. We are really doing something. And when we see who we are and go on with seeing who we are, I think the effect around us must be profound, even although it, you may say it's very limited, it's not very extensive. I'm not so sure about it not being extensive. I believe that you can't measure these things on a map. you can't say enlightenment as, you know, spread about 10 miles from Reading. You see, it isn't that kind of thing. Well, let me put it like this. Well, we have to get rid of the idea, not of one box or two boxes, but three boxes. The first box I get rid of here, the central box here, is a brain box, a legal box, a physical box. Get rid of this. It doesn't care at all. The second thing I have to get rid of is a mind box. Because I get the idea that when I've got rid of this legal box here, there's a residual plastic bag here full of mind. Well, it is not so in my experience. But I find that my mind is blown too, and my mind is worldwide. And as a great Zen master, Huinong, said, I think the mind abideth nowhere. It abideth everywhere, really, that the mind is blown. So the mind box is blown. But there's a third box, which is apt to hang around, and that is an enlightenment box. And I can think that Douglas has got enlightenment. But I've got, you know, that I haven't got a head, and I haven't got a mind here, but I've got enlightenment. And it's, you see, and it's shut up in an enlightenment box. And you poor souls, some of you, alas, aren't enlightened. But this is absolute rubbish. Absolute rubbish. Because as Kuzuki says, and many others say, it is not oneself as a human being that is enlightened, it is the universe that comes to self-consciousness in oneself. But the desire for enlightenment in me is the universe wanting to become self-conscious. The cosmos is self-aware in me when I see who I am. It isn't a human being seeing it's not a human being, which is ridiculous. At the center of our being is not a human being, it is the source of Jehovah. And when we see who we are, it is the Buddha nature, or source, or reality, self-aware in us. Several things follow from this. One is we can take their personal credit. The second thing, which is the real point of this, is that enlightenment spills over by nature. And I believe that if you see who you are in East Springfield, I believe that the people in the furthest star are affected. You may say this is blind faith. I don't think it is really. It's seeing what is the nature of enlightenment. Nature of enlightenment is that one sees who one really is. One doesn't see who a human being is. One sees who one really is. And this is the universe coming to self-awareness. Therefore, I am going to suggest to you that to remain unenlightened about who one is to be socially irresponsible. I repeat that. We think of enlightenment as something which we might catch on to perhaps after years of meditation or lifetime of meditation and so on. But it is something which anyway doesn't concern us now and we can afford to neglect. But it is something we can put off without injury to our fellow man. I suggest not so. I suggest to put off your enlightenment, which is so simple and obvious, for another 6 seconds, is to be socially irresponsible. I don't mean this unkindly, and I think to want to see this is a good start to be interested. Is a good start, and if we don't see this very clearly at the moment, at least let us inquire, let us look until we see the obvious. But to neglect this question of who am I is, I suggest, to be really socially irresponsible.